You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Natalie Haynes is the author of 6 books, including the nonfiction work Pandora's Jar, which was a New York Times bestseller, and the novels A Thousand Ships, which was a national bestseller and shortlisted for the 2020 Women's Prize for Fiction, and Stone Blind. She's written and recorded 9 series of Natalie Haynes Stands Up for the Classics for the BBC. Her new book is Divine Might, Goddesses in Greek Myth. Thank you for joining me, Natalie.
It's my pleasure. Hello.
Now, as both a caution to the listeners and a question for you, the following conversation is going to be all about the Greek myths, and
yes,
the Greek myth narratives are rife, chock-a-block with sex, violence, and the star of the Greek myths is a serial sexual assault offender who would be locked up for life, I guess, eternal life.
Yeah,
were he to be a resident of our country or any other civilized country in the world today. So the listener should know that Zeus is a terrible, terrible non-human being.
Yeah.
And
Greek myth is full of terrible non-human beings, let us be honest.
Yes. Given the title of your book, which is Goddesses in Greek Myth, the subtitle that
yes.
is. Talk about, you know, the Greek myths as being based and starring a figure who is the antithesis of everything women want and represent.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question, is how did societies which were so patriarchal as ancient Greek societies create goddesses who were incredibly powerful when human women, mortal women, had no clout at all? You know, they didn't have any kind of personal freedoms. They couldn't vote. They had no, yeah, often they couldn't own property and things like that. So they were totally disenfranchised citizens, certainly in, you know, 5th century Athens, just to pick one society as an example. And yet at the same time, we have these really very patriarchal societies where older men often have a great deal of power over younger men as well as all women. And yet there everyone goes off to worship goddesses who have incredible, disproportionate power. So Athens has, it must have one of the most recognizable skylines in the world, I would say, perhaps the most recognizable skyline in the world. And it has had for 2.5 millennia with the Parthenon, that incredible temple right up on the Acropolis. But that's a temple to Athene, a goddess. It's not a temple to Zeus. You know, the great temple to Zeus was Olympias, I think, and long gone. And so, you know, Athenians worshipped Athene or celebrated Athene. She's obviously their protecting goddess, in an incredibly public and enthusiastic way. So not only do they have a huge statue of Athene in the Parthenon, and the statue of Athene Parthenos that stood in there was perhaps, you know, 11, 12 meters high and covered in ivory and gold. So it would have been really bling, quite on top of everything else. But that's not even the biggest statue of Athene that was on the high points of Athens. That was probably the Athene Promachos, Athene in the front line of battle. So that shows her as a warrior, which obviously Athens really, you know, treasures, that sees itself often as a warrior society. And so for that, she would have the helmet on that we're used to seeing her wearing, tilted slightly back. She would have her aegis, her breastplate. She'd have her spear in hand. And you could see that statue of her from Sunion. It's about 30 miles from Athens. So you knew as you approached Athens that you were approaching an incredibly rich and powerful city-state. And so not only do the Greeks worship their gods and goddesses, but they also use their goddesses to exert their influence elsewhere. I find it really extraordinary that it's Athene who is the center of this, and not, as we might expect, Zeus, you know, and Greece is a place of islands and coasts. Plato says that the Greeks live like frogs around a pond. And so you'd expect Poseidon to be right up there, but nope, there she is taking up the space. And some of the temples that we can no longer see, the temple of Hera, wife and sister, sorry, I do see it's gross, but that's Greek myth for you, of Zeus. The temple of her at Samos was probably three times the size of the Parthenon. I mean, it's unimaginably huge. And so these goddesses played this really central role in daily life in ancient Greece. And yet at the same time, yes, they live alongside. I mean, the best thing you could say about Zeus is that he's a serial sexual predator, a serial rapist, a serial murderer, a serial torturer. And of course, he's got perpetual life, so he'll be doing it forever. It's why I managed to keep a bit of sympathy in my heart for Hera when people say what a monster she is, and often she is. But she is bound forever to a coercively controlling and outright violent husband from whom she can never be released. It's not like she can just wait for him to die. When's that going to happen? Never. He's immortal.
You know, as I read this, one of the things that I think you do that's very interesting is you give us all the narratives of the goddesses you're talking about, and they're often different from different sources and conflicting. Mm. And this made me think that in the other, our modern religions, Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, that all of those have one God, one book, one text for the most part. Mm. And the Greeks who were polytheistic, they had a mess of gods and they had a mess of different narratives about gods.
Yeah, and absolutely. There's no real version or original version, or, you know, people ask me a lot, well, what happens in the original version? I think generally what they mean is what happens in the earliest version that we know, but often the earliest version that we know is wildly different from later versions. And sometimes the best known versions aren't even Greek. Sometimes they're Roman versions. So Ovid's Metamorphoses, the long poem that he wrote about Greek myth and the transformations that happen within it, often that's the version of a myth that we know best. But of course, he's writing hundreds and hundreds of years, nearly a millennium after, you know, our earliest sources. It's just, it's a really difficult thing to try and get your head around, but there isn't a right version. And I'm sure theologians would tell us that there were different books that have gone on to comprise the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Bible, and that, you know, different texts rivaled one another before they eventually sort of picked a version which becomes the fixed version. But I do love the kind of the uncertainty of the story is really baked into Greek myth. So in Hesiod's Theogony, it's the story of how the gods were born. So you would think this would be, the Greeks aren't very, you know, precious about their texts. I don't think they see them as things that you have to obey or follow. They're more descriptions. It's a descriptive way of looking at the world rather than a prescriptive way. But in Hesiod's Theogony, he's going to tell us how the world began, which for him is not the Big Bang or anything. So 20th century, there's nothingness. The Greek word is chaos, but it doesn't mean chaos like something chaotic. It means a big void, like a chasm. And then from that comes forth the heavens and then the earth and then, you know, various later gods, the Titans, and then the Olympian gods that we might know more about. And the reason that he can tell us this, he says, is because the muses themselves, the goddesses who invented music and poetry, turn up and they tell him. So they're really reliable witnesses. And you go, great, I've got some narrative authority here. But here's the thing. The muses appear to Hesiod and they say, hello, Hesiod, we're the muses and we'll tell you everything you want to know. But here's the thing. We can sing lies and make them sound like the truth. And you go, wait, what? So the first authoritative narrator has just told me I can't rely on them. Well, now what am I supposed to think? I sort of think there's something kind of lovely about that degree of uncertainty being there right from the earliest. You know, Hesiod is around the same time, perhaps a little later than Homer. This is as early as Greek literature gets, as early as quite a lot of literature gets, truthfully. And there it is. Yeah, maybe, maybe not. We don't know. They might be lying. It's right there.
I guess, you know, I hadn't thought of it that way, but fake news. Not so new.
Yeah, not so new. But also there's something really reassuring in a way, I think, that if there are always going to be contradictory versions of a story, then in a way, it gives you a kind of a sense of safety, that there doesn't have to be a right version that you have to learn and live by. There are just going to be lots of versions. You don't see, there are lots of wars in ancient societies, but you don't see many religious wars in polytheistic societies over gods. You know, you see it over territory for sure. You see it when, you know, Athens manages to declare war against its near neighbors and then start another war against another neighbor. And you're like, oh, guys, stop it. But they don't invade over who calls which god which.
You know, I really loved it, the way you developed this. And one of the things I think that it makes books, it's a thrilling book to read, really.
Thank you.
The reason it's thrilling is because you're there in it, kind of weaving, providing both just the perspective level in the prose. The way you write the prose is really lively and entertaining. And you bring yourself in occasionally. Talk about creating this style to deal with the classics, which just feels, I mean, it's almost too much fun to be the classics.
Yes, and you will almost not notice you're accidentally learning things. That's always my goal. I used to be a stand-up comedian. I studied classics really young. So I took triple classics A-levels in the UK, which I'm sure would now not be allowed and shouldn't probably have been allowed then. So I took Latin, Greek, and ancient history at 16. I stopped studying everything else. And then my undergraduate degree is in classics. I went to Cambridge. But while I was at Cambridge, I started performing as a stand-up comedian. Cambridge has this really long tradition of comedy with things like The Footlights, which provided you with, Hugh Laurie, Emma Thompson, John Oliver, who, you know, he's done okay, I think. And before all of them, a reasonable chunk of Monty Python. So there's a noble tradition of comedy happening in Cambridge, and I started doing stand-up comedy there. And that was my job for a decade after I graduated. So I'd spent a lot of time trying to persuade audiences to listen to me and find me funny before I started trying to persuade them that they should read me and maybe learn stuff about classics that they didn't know. So I think the two kind of came into their own when I started making the radio series. It's also a podcast for the BBC. Natalie Haynes stands up for the classics. But in my novels are often really sad, you know. Stoneblind is a really sad book. A Thousand Ships is a really sad book. But my nonfiction, I always feel like I can put aside the sadness. I alternate between them. So I allow myself to be as unhappy and melancholy as someone can be writing novels. And then I switch to the nonfiction. I'm like, let me tell you a cool story because this is great. And that's basically my motivating force throughout writing my nonfiction. I want to have all the fun of finding out brilliant things and then doing my absolute best to tell you about them without any of the kind of pain, I suppose, of living through the awful things that happen to people in Bronze Age societies, and particularly that happened to women in Bronze Age societies.
You know, it's appropriate that you start the book with the muses, because you're going to tell a story, their story first, and that's, again, appropriate. Talk about the muses as an influence, not just in daily life, but also in the, you know, the creation of narrative. They are the embodiment of narrative, and we as humans define ourselves with narrative. So they are much more important than you might at first suspect.
No, absolutely. And the Greeks are really aware of it, you know, that there is no story if you don't have the muse of your particular area of story to help you out. That's why the Iliad begins, "Sing, goddess, Thea," but he means the muse Calliope, the muse of epic poetry, "of the wrath of Achilles." And the Odyssey begins, "Tell me, muse, musa, about this man who's been turned every which way." That would be Odysseus, of course. Homer knows perfectly well that if the muse chooses not to speak through him, he's not going to have an epic poem. He's not going to have a 24-book poem about this stuff. The muse needs to provide it. "Tell me, muse, sing, goddess." She's the one who's going to do the storytelling. He's just going to help out, you know? He's like an amanuensis, I guess. And then, of course, what happens to muses, and that's always true through ancient poetry. You get poets appealing to the muse, "Please help me, muse, you know, please help me tell the story." If she doesn't help you, you're just not going to have a story to tell. And it's not just a narrative art, it's also a performance. So the muses, along with Apollo, they invent music. That's why the words are so similar in sound. a museum is the home of the muses, a shrine to the muses, museum. So muses occupy space across lots of different arts and also sciences. Urania, the muse of astronomy. So don't think that the scientists don't also need a little creative help sometimes. I think we forget that sometimes in the modern world. It's like arts on this side, useful science subjects on this side. It's like for the Greeks, that would be nonsensical. You definitely need them both. And I feel very much the same. So the muses are inspirational to poets, to everybody who wants to do creative thinking, and you can't really get anywhere without them. But they're also, you know, they're our inner show-off made form. You know, if they don't give you the confidence to perform, your voice is going to crack, your lyre is going to, you know, the strings are going to break. It's just not going to work for you if you try to challenge them to a battle of strength, as happens with one man, Themiras, who thinks he can outsing them in a contest. When he loses, they take away his ability to make music at all, and they turn him blind. So they don't mess about, these muses. And it always seems a terrible shame to me that by the 20th century, muses have stopped being this incredible creative force. And they've been sort of, they've turned into essentially a basically naked woman that a male artist finds attractive, is essentially what the word muse comes to mean by the time of, say, Picasso. And it's like, well, you know, I prefer approaching the muses in a slightly more old-fashioned, by which I would definitely mean Greek, sense, and, you know, appealing to a muse when you begin a project, rather than just assuming that she's, you know, on tap to help out whenever you decide. There's a gorgeous part of the Sandman stories, Neil Gaiman's Sandman graphic novels, where the muse of poetry turns up and she finds herself trapped by a writer who doesn't have inspiration any other way. I don't want to spoil it, but I'm sure that lots of your listeners will probably have seen it already. But for those who haven't, it's great.
You know, this brings up one of the things I really love about this book is that you give us the muses in their original forms and the Greek goddesses in their original forms as conceived of by the Greeks, but then you follow them through history and show that that same interest in whatever the goddess is a goddess of rises again and again. And
yes,
this suggests to me, in a sense, that all the Greek gods and goddesses are sort of like a Rorschach test for humanity's interest in various aspects of where the gods and goddesses reside. And that's why, you know, this ancient religion will never die.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably an acquaintance of mine once said that we're all destined to discover Greek myths for ourselves. You know, each generation discovers them anew. And I think that's really true. You know, we don't all... I was really lucky that I got to study Greek and Latin at school. Most people don't get to in this country or any other. And so I'm very conscious that I was lucky to have these stories in my life from a really young age. I started Latin at 11 and ancient Greek at 14. But a lot of us come to classics through a different route. You know, we come through Percy Jackson, maybe, or we come through, for my generation, Disney Hercules, or, you know, whichever version of the Greeks you get, they're all going to be different. You know, Clash of the Titans in 1981, for me, the Ray Harryhausen stop motion animation was just amazing. But for my parents, who'd seen Jason and the Argonauts in 1963 with the terrifying skeletal warriors, you know, there's always a route into the classics. And we all kind of pick it up our own way. And so each time, myth is a mirror, right? So it reflects the time in which it is set. It reflects the time in which it's created, and it reflects the time in which it's perceived or read or seen, absorbed, you know? So it has these multiple timelines lurking within it. So when we look at, I don't know, the story of Helen of Troy, Helen of Sparta, as she starts out, we probably see it differently from the way the ancient Greeks saw it. And we probably also see it differently from the way the makers of original series Star Trek saw it in the 1960s, when they decided to take a version of Helen, Elan, as they make her, and have an episode where she's incredibly beautiful and also she doesn't want to get married. And it's, you know, we're always playing with and rediscovering these myths in different ways. And I think the muses are a really good example of that. You know, they shift and change through time. And I think maybe we are in danger of forgetting that everybody has a version of Greek myths, no matter when or where or who they are when they encounter them, there's always going to be something that looks right back at you.
You know, you spoke earlier of Hera, who is Zeus's wife, and she's incredibly powerful.
And also
incredibly conflicted too. And I think that that's a really interesting, you know, way to approach these characters, because unlike most gods, these are not perfect and unknowable. These gods are very much like humans,
and they
embrace contradictions that would be impossible for a perfect god.
Yes, and in a way that makes them more relatable, I think, that, you know, straight away you see that these contradictions aren't just in you, you know, they're also in, and the Greeks, you know, invented their gods and goddesses, I think, in their own reflection, in their own image. Xenophanes famously said that if horses and lions and oxen had hands and could draw, that their gods would look like horses and lion and oxen. And so that's, you know, people often ask me, why are Greek gods so horrible? You know, how did you worship such a horrible god? And I always say the same thing, which is, you know, this is a world where there's no forensic science. There's no, you know, the level of scientific inquiry is intense, but there's a lot of missing information. And if you live in a world where an earthquake can destroy your home in a heartbeat, could take your a shipwreck could take your family in just a matter of seconds, are you going to think that the world is intrinsically kind and lovely? Or are you going to see that it has these cruel, strange quirks of fate in it? And the answer, I think, is very probably the latter. Now, we would know that earthquakes are caused by moving tectonic plates, but the Greeks can't possibly have known that 2.5 millennia ago. So for them, it's Poseidon smacking his trident into the earth. And it's like, well, it's an explanation that fills a gap. They know earthquakes come from somewhere. And so there you are. You need an explanation for why awful things suddenly happen. Artemis, I think, is in a way, she's even more conflicted than Hera. You know, Hera is very representative of her constituency. She is a married woman and she's married to a patriarch who she can deceive and cheat, and she often does. But the reason that she does is because he is incredibly fickle, absolutely and constantly unfaithful to her, and physically violent towards her when he feels that will make his point. And so she spends a lot of time plotting against him, and people say, oh, Hera is such a horrible goddess, she's always, you know, plotting and scheming. And it's like, well, yeah, but you have to remember, don't you, that she's in this coercive relationship which will never end. She's got to find a way to live in it, you know, because she can't die. And Artemis similarly, you know, she's the protective goddess of young girls, just as her brother Apollo is the protective god of young boys. But of course, you know, children, I'm afraid, died in huge quantities in the ancient world. About a third of people in early societies didn't make it through to adulthood because, you know, being born is incredibly dangerous. Surviving childhood is incredibly difficult. And if you make it to your teens, if you're a girl, you'll start giving birth, incredibly dangerous. If you're a boy, you'll start fighting in wars, incredibly dangerous. So it is you can see why you would need a goddess to explain the sudden death of young girls, or a god to explain the sudden death of young boys. And so both Artemis and Apollo are shown almost always with a bow and arrows, you know, ready to suddenly pick off a target. And, you know, of course you make offerings to the goddess Artemis, hoping it won't be your daughter. But in a world where so many children die, you must have always known the idea of parental grief was not too far away. So you have these very cruel, these very capricious gods, because you're trying to make sense of a natural world which feels cruel and capricious.
You know, one of the things I think you do very well in this book is you mentioned early on that you were, you know, educated in Greek, all these different languages, and you often in this book will cite the meaning of a Greek word, which we now have a word for, But in Greece, the meaning was more diffuse, leaned in different directions. I think you do a really good job of using the evolution of language to enlarge your story and give it, you know, complexity and density and make it really interesting, too. It's fascinating to find out, you know, that words we think mean one thing derived from a word that means something much more diffuse. Talk about using translation as an element in your narrative.
Well, I'm lucky in that I can go back and translate the Greek or the Latin when I need to. And that's great, because what I want to do is try and show you not necessarily the most elegant or beautiful version of a Greek text, but the version which will at least give you an idea of what it might have meant to someone who was Greek. And so often what you see is a trope of translation, which just has become something that people accept, but there's actually no basis for it in ancient Greek. So the example I always use, I wrote about this in Pandora's Jar, the prequel, I suppose, to Divine Might, a book about women in Greek myth, Divine Might goddesses in Greek myth. But one of Hercules's labors, or Heracles, if you prefer his Greek name, is to bring back the war belt, and the word in Greek is zoster, war belt of Hippolyta, who's an Amazon queen, right? And over again, you see translations until incredibly recently that translate it as girdle, the girdle of Hippolyta. Now, the absolute best case translation of that is that it's an ungendered belt. In Midsummer Night's Dream, Puck says he'll put a girdle around the earth. So it's just a plain leather, I guess, belt, and that's it. But the word for that in Greek is zoner, right? So that's a woman's belt or an ungendered belt, a plain belt. A zoster is a war belt. It's what's worn by Agamemnon in the Trojan War. In the Iliad, the commander of the Greek forces wears a zoster, a big war belt with all his weapons that he can put in. So this is what Hippolyta is wearing. You know, she's given it by her father Ares, the god of war. It's a war belt. And yet you will search in vain for a translation that uses that word, the kind of masculine idea of a war belt, something worn by a man on a battlefield. The whole idea of Amazons is that they're very, very strange. They're not proper Greeks because they're non-Greek. They're not proper women because they're on a battlefield. They're not proper men because they're women. It's all too strange for the Greeks, who are very confused by the Amazons. They wear trousers. What's going on with that? Normal men wear skirts, etc. That's how we can assume that they were viewed. They were seen with great excitement by ancient Greeks. But for a Greek, when you look at this story, then this great warrior, Hercules, is going to ask Hippolyta for her war belt, her zoster, and she hands it over without a fight. Right? Then there's a war afterwards. That's a whole separate issue. Hera might be a little bit responsible for that one. But over and over again, translations say girdle, which sounds like a woman's undergarment. You know, it sounds not at all like what she is. She's a strong warrior. And it's like, I see what you mean, but it's just wrong. You know, it's a bad translation of the Greek, quite aside from anything else. And so I like to go back to the Greek or to the Latin to try and strip away that these are just like a habit that people have got into in translations, I think, these sort of shorthands. But it's not in the Greek. That's my t-shirt for this book. I'm sorry, that's just not in the Greek. And so I'm just there going, but she doesn't have that kind of belt. She doesn't have one of those. So yes, that's why Pandora's Jar was called Pandora's Jar, because she doesn't have a box at all, ever, until Erasmus, like 2,000 years after the story first comes up.
When you were talking about the war belt, I must admit, all I could think of was Batman's utility belt.
Yes, correct. This is always the right answer. Yeah. So if Batgirl also has a utility belt, a la Batman, then now we're finally getting to the level we want to be at. Bat belt is definitely better than girdle, as far as I'm concerned. So I give everyone open permission to translate it as that.
You know, as I read this book, one of the things I found really enjoyable was that so many times I'd see names, words, names of places, you'd give strings of events, and I think, boy, that's like, you know, that's the basis, that's where this came from, that's where that came from. And in particular, I'm thinking of the golden apples of the sun, which
causing trouble.
Which I, of course, being me, I thought Oh my God, that's where Ray Bradbury got that great title from.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And, always a fan of Ray Bradbury over here.
And also, there's a famous Morton Subotnick electronic composition called The Silver Apples of the Moon.
Right. Yep. So, and is that based on Yeats, I think? Is it a Yeats poem that is inspired by the, I think it is, that's inspired by the notion of the golden apples, the apples of the Hesperides? But you're right, they appear so often in Greek myth. And, you know, we've gone on to have, you can really see it in cinema, I think, and to a lesser extent also on TV. We love a, what is it, they're called a MacGuffin, a thing where a hero or heroine has to go and get a thing. And the thing itself might not necessarily do anything important, although definitely sometimes it's the, you know, code which will unlock the thing, which will make the thing happen. Sometimes it's the code which will stop the thing exploding that will destroy the thing. But sometimes it's just a thing, and that's its only function. And the golden apples are very much like that. You can't use them to do anything particularly useful, but they are so desirable that whenever anyone sees them, they have to have them. So, you know, famously, of course, we have the golden apple that's offered up as a prize in the beauty contest between Aphrodite and Athene and Hera. The golden apple is inscribed with the Greek words ter kalista, for the most beautiful, and the word ending is female, feminine, so for the most beautiful woman or the most beautiful goddess. And this apple is thrown into their midst at the wedding of Thetis, mother of Achilles, as she'll go on to be, and Peleus, and they argue over who should get it. Zeus opts out of doing the judging himself because he knows this way only leads to crying. Probably him and definitely everyone else. And so he co-opts Paris, a Trojan prince, to make the decision. And Paris famously awards it to Aphrodite in exchange for the bribe that is marriage for with the most beautiful woman in the world, Helen of Sparta, as she is then. But that's not the only story of the golden apples. They also appear, Atlas has some, I think, and he's incredibly protective of them. And really terrified that somebody will come and steal them from him. But they also appear in Atalanta's foot race. And I love this because I'm a very keen runner too. But Atalanta is a beautiful young woman who can run like the wind. I cannot, just to be clear. And a young, beautiful young man called Hippomenes wants to marry her. But the deal is that if you want to marry her, you have to beat her in a foot race. And if you lose, death. If you win, she'll marry you. And every single suitor who's tried, this is how beautiful she is, fails. And but Hippomenes is desperate to win, desperate to marry Atalanta. And so he prays to Aphrodite, and Aphrodite gives him three golden apples with which he can waylay Atalanta. So as they run, Atalanta's miles better than him, but he's so handsome, she doesn't want to beat him. She wants him to not die. You know, this is such a Taylor Swift moment, I can't tell you. She's so superior to him, and yet she can't help but love him because he's gorgeous. It's like, I feel like I've heard this song. And so he tosses a golden apple, you know, onto the ground, and she diverts from the racing line, goes off, picks it up, and then he does it again because she's still miles quicker than him. And she goes off, and then right towards the end, he throws the third apple a really long way from the racing line, and she is so desperate for it and so much secretly doesn't want him to be killed that she diverts herself, picks up the apple, and they get married and live happily ever. Well, I say happily ever after. They have a very brief happily ever after, and then they're turned into, do you know what? You'll have to read the book to find out.
You know, one of the things that I really like about this book, as I read it, I started I got a much better understanding of what the Greek myths were and as our most essential text, and this reaches up through, I think, all writing, our most essential texts are supernatural soap operas.
Absolutely. There are, I mean, because the things that soap operas don't tend to have, I once made a documentary about this for the BBC, about Greek tragedy and soap opera. And how the overlaps form, because soap operas tend to have unity of time and unity of place, which is exactly what Aristotle said Greek tragedy had to have, right? So you have one location. This is why you so often have the location as the name of a soap opera. I guess Peyton Place is the obvious, or Beverly Hills 90210, a really specific location.
Unity Dallas. Of place.
Right? Unity of time. Now, is it Dallas that subverts this, though, because it has a dream sequence in it? Or was that Dynasty? I can't remember. Dallas, I think.
Yes.
But generally, time moves forwards, right? You don't have flashbacks, not very often anyway. Every now and then you subvert it. But the other thing you need, ideally, is a conflict that cannot easily be resolved, where there's no good choice to make. So essentially, you have that. You see it all the time in soaps, where you have a patriarch often who's got to, you know, favor one child over the other in order to allow this thing to, you know, who's going to succeed him. Oh, succession again, following a very Greek path. And so you have to make a bad choice. Whatever you do, someone's going to be angry and upset, and then they're going to take revenge, and then someone's going to take revenge on them, and so on and so on. So you need this intergenerational and intrafamilial toxicity. And the Greek gods and goddesses have that in abundance. They're a gigantic blended family where basically I would say fully two-thirds of them are out and out narcissists and sociopaths. There is never going to be a happy ending to any of these stories. So they just keep giving more narrative. You know, there's always going to be another bit where somebody goes, oh, I hate her. She did this to me, so I'm going to do this to her. And you're like, oh no, here we go. But there it is.
And as it's interesting to me too, that the narrative driver is the flaws in character, as you mentioned, many and ubiquitous to everybody, in immortal, divine, essentially perfect beings. And that's such a, in itself, that is a really great, I guess, in a sense, it's a flaw in the logic, but it shows that all of humanity's creations are first and foremost quite human.
I think that's one of the most interesting things about Greek myth, and one of the reasons why Greek myth is so resonant to us today, because the unit of currency in Greek myth is always a human life, right? So even when there are gods and monsters involved, everything operates at a really human level. You know, even when the gods are unencumbered by boring mortals clogging things up, they still behave in a way which is so petty and so trivial at times that you think, yep, I know that person also. Yeah, I mean, the thing that's different, I suppose, is that there are very few consequences for the gods, their actions. There are lots of consequences for us, for mortals, and that's why you get this incredible, like I say, it's like a story generator over and over again. Hera always wants the Greeks to win the Trojan War. She always wants it. She loathes Troy. She will always campaign for the Greeks. And I think one of the reasons that we so often see her as being horrible is because in the Iliad, she's relentlessly horrible to the Trojans. She'll see Troy wiped out, even if she has to lose another city as payback later on. She'll take it if Troy can only be destroyed. But the thing is, if you're Greek, then another way of looking at that viciousness is that she's always trying to fly the flag for you. She's always trying to look out for you. She always wants the Greeks to win, always. And so she's an incredibly loyal goddess from a Greek perspective, even though she's a terrifying monster from a Trojan perspective. And what's so fascinating, I think, about the Iliad is that she and her husband, very unusually, are on the same side, right? They both know that Greece is going to win the Trojan War. This has been foretold, it's going to happen, so we all know it. And yet, in book one of the Iliad, Zeus does a sort of sneaky behind-the-scenes deal with Thetis, mother of Achilles. And so for the duration of the poem, for at least the first 17, 18 books of the poem, the Trojans are going to flourish, because Achilles has been insulted by the Greeks. So they now have to suffer. So they desperately want him back. And then they'll be sorry for having been mean to him, which is what's happened up to now, right? And so for the duration of the poem, and remember, the Iliad is the great Trojan War narrative, but it's only 2 months in duration. You know, it only covers a tiny bit in the final, the 10th year of the war. And for the whole poem, therefore, Zeus and Hera are sort of at odds. And you know, they have a huge contretemps more than once, both in book one and then again later on, after she sort of secretly seduces him so that she can get him to fall asleep so that the Greeks can advance while he's unconscious. And she gets everybody involved. She's got, you know, the god of sleep involved. She's got Aphrodite involved. She's getting everyone on board to help her get Zeus out of the way for a little bit. And he's furious when he wakes up and he yells at all the gods. And it's like, how did you two manage to be arguing about this. You're on the same side. And yet that's who they are. They are exactly that married couple who, no matter what, will argue about something. If they're on, you know, if there's any chance of taking differing sides, they'll take them. And even when there isn't, they somehow manage to take the same side in a way that means they argue. You sort of have to admire that level of commitment to being cross.
At the beginning of the segment on Venus, you described the Botticelli painting, which is incredibly gorgeous. And you use painting and art in this book to kind of help tell the story. And I think that that's very interesting because art is a very powerful means of storytelling. And nowadays we have graphic novels, which kind of try to mix up the media. Talk about using art, and also I love the transition from, you know, Botticelli to Baron Munchausen movie.
Yeah, which is, and then, you know, from there to Lady Gaga, you know, in a music video. Because Aphrodite or Venus, you know, Greek name, Roman name, same goddess, is she must be one of the most artistically inspirational figures of all time. You know, she's probably the first naked female statue in European history. The Aphrodite of Cnidos was 4th century BCE. So we have statues of naked male figures before then, but the naked Aphrodite, this is the one. And it was so incredibly popular. It was a tourist attraction. You know, people came across the Greek world to come and stare at this gorgeous naked Aphrodite of Cnidos. And she's continued to be, because she's always shown coming from the sea. Aphrodite, sometimes is, we're given to understand it can mean born from the foam, given from the foam. So she's often coming out of the sea, as in Botticelli's Birth of Venus. Sometimes, you know, basically at any point in the Iliad where she's had enough, she disappears to Cyprus for a bath. She's like, that's it, I'm off to Cyprus for a bath. But it always makes me think of Lisa Simpson going, if anyone needs me, I'll be in my room. But there we are. And so she's often shown naked in the process of thinking about getting dry. She's a very wet goddess, it's fair to say. And so it means that artists throughout history have been able to show her naked, which is obviously something that historically male artists have very much enjoyed doing. And so, of course, when Botticelli paints her, she is just, it's a gigantic painting and she looks absolutely incredible, you know, coming out of this seashell. There's a god, Zephyr, a god of wind blowing at her. So her hair is all going towards her. So she's got the wind machine. It's like, how many music videos are you planning to make on this a single day? And so, of course, it was going to be the case that, you know, and Zephyr's one of my favorite details of that picture. It's really easily overlooked. Is that he's with his girlfriend, you know, and he's holding her and she's kind of wrapping herself around him as he's blowing the hair away from Aphrodite's body so he can get a better eyeful. She's like, ahem, I'm over here, mate. And then, of course, when Baron Munchausen came out, which is an incredibly long time ago now, then that scene is recreated with Uma Thurman, who was just a teenager. Uma Thurman as Aphrodite or Venus, as I think she is in the film, being born in the same way. You know, there are lots of things that make you feel slightly uncomfortable with that scene. The men in it are both wearing clothes while Venus is naked. And also they're a lot older than her. And you're like, oh, this looks really now. But, you know, she is just, it's just an extraordinary image. You know, Gilliam really understood the art that he was paying homage to. And then, you know, just in the last few years, Lady Gaga comes along and writes the song Venus, and the music video for that shows her, you know, in this incredibly kind of post-classical mansion where there's, it sort of looks a bit like a Greek temple or maybe a Roman temple. The colors are all super bright. You know, she's an injured, is she an injured Eros? Or I don't know. It's the iconography of it is all jumbled around. The real housewives of LA, I think, could turn up to play instruments and they're all bright pink. And it's like, what? And it's just this fantastic riot of inspiration. It's sexy, it's funny, it's, you know, slightly seedy. And you're like, well, yes, all those things are present in the goddess Aphrodite. We should find all those elements of her in it. And my absolute favorite thing about that Lady Gaga song is that there's a version which I didn't know about because I don't live in the States. which went out on Thanksgiving some years ago, where the Muppets, are her special guests, or she's maybe, I don't know which way around it would be. I think she's probably their special guest, isn't she? And so they perform the role of her backing singers and dancers on the song Venus, dancing in this really regimented way. And you're like, well, there you go. Everything from Praxiteles, the 4th century sculptor of Aphrodite of Knidos, right the way through to the Muppets. This is what it means to be a goddess who does not decline in power.
You know, one of the things about this book is it's so unexpected. As you read it, you know, you use a lot of humor and you do that really well.
Thank you.
To talk about using the humor and also, you know, just making a, a really interesting reading experience. When you lead off the chapter on Artemis with the monologue that Ian Holm gives in
Alien.
Alien.
Yeah, I do that. So. Yes, I mean, you know, she's a born predator. And so I was looking at Jaws, I was looking at Alien, I was looking at Terminator, because there's something about the images that we see very frequently of Artemis and also of Apollo in ancient art. They almost invariably have these totally impassive faces, as they are creating absolute carnage in every direction. There are, you know, the story of the Niobids, where the two of them kill 14 children of a single mother, Niobe. She loses 7 sons and 7 daughters in a single day because she foolishly boasts that she's more fertile than Leto, the mother of Apollo and Artemis. And so they punish her instantly by wiping out all her children. And every version of this, you think this is such a horrifying revenge for what is, let's be honest, what seems like quite a minor crime, transgression, maybe it's just boasting, but the payback is awful and instant. And you would think it would look like it hurt, you know, but it doesn't. There they are, and they're just completely like blank-faced as they just assassinate child after child, and you're like, oh my goodness. And so, yeah, it absolutely reminded me of the moment in Alien where they realized that this thing has no soul as they would perceive it. It has no kindness. There's nothing you can appeal to. It's just a force which will take life until it is stopped. And similarly with the Terminator, it felt to me like a really good example that I could employ. But yes, I think there's often a temptation for people writing about classics and Greek myth and so on to sort of feel like we need to show you how important it is and how important we would love you to find out how important it is to us. But important doesn't mean deathly serious. You can be really serious about something and still appreciate that there are comic moments in it. There are jokes in Greek tragedies that they're not my jokes, they're jokes that were put in by Euripides. You know, there are jokes in every ancient text, really, I think, or certainly in lots of ancient texts. And so it just seems a shame to me to kind of get too committed to the, is this very serious and important? Well, to me, it is really important and I take it really seriously. But you know what? I used to be a professional comedian. So when I give something my professional attention, there's probably going to be jokes in it also.
Also, too, I think that you do a fantastic job of showing how important these are. Because, as I said, when you're reading through this book, there's a bazillion names of a bazillion Greek gods, goddesses, characters in the sagas, places, paintings, and many of those have been spun off and picked up into the American language here and now, and you go, oh, that's why this is, that's where that name comes from. That's where that name comes from. So you demonstrate the importance not by telling, but by showing.
Yeah, I hope so. Because, you know, these things are around us all the time. They're part of our world, whether we're sort of aware of it or not. And that's been true for a really long time. You know, Greek myth, particularly as told by Ovid in the Metamorphoses, was such an inspirational part of the Renaissance. You know, if you look at visual arts from that period, then there are two really major texts that are being painted. One is the Bible and the other is Ovid's Metamorphoses. So these stories are with us all the time, you know, And it just seems like that you don't need me to tell you that they're important. You do need me to show you where they might be and where they're sort of hiding in plain sight sometimes. And so sometimes it's, you know, like you say, it's linguistic, it's what we call somewhere, or it's sometimes it's visual. It's that gigantic Athenian Nashville. I mean, how cool is that? Sometimes it's, you know, something as unlikely as, yes, a Muppets holiday special with Lady Gaga. I feel fine that all these things are inspired by classics. It just goes to show that, you know, a long time ago, I used to teach with a really lovely man who used to say that the house of Western thought had many rooms, but only one basement. And I love that. That's an idea, even though I'm not completely sure what Western thought is. I do love the idea that classics sort of forms a basement for all this stuff. You know, that's in our foundations. So I think I'm probably, my job is basically to open the cellar door and say, let's come and have a look at this. It's cool.
Well, as I read this book, it was really fun, just really fun to read and discover. Once you get the vibe of what you're doing and you have a definite structure that you follow, but it's not something that's obvious at first. It's revealed as you read the book. And talk about creating a structure that is revealed rather than just saying, okay, I'm going to do this. But you do that in a subtle way and there's changes to it. But by the end of the book, you realize, boy, she had a really good map to make this book a hell of a good read.
Yeah, I love structure. I'm a total structure hound. And I know there are lots of authors who don't worry about it. You know, the structure just appears in their work as they go. But it's the first thing I think of is, what shape is this book going to be? What shape am I going to make it? And to me, in my head anyway, it's three-dimensional as I'm kind of building it. That's how it feels. And it's like, I'm going to take you this way, and then I'm going to take you around this corner, and then we're going to go here, and then we're going to do that. And so I was really conscious of the fact that it would have a sort of, at the most basic level, that you'd get a chapter on each one of these goddesses. But I also thought it would be fun to begin the book with the muses, because that's how all ancient artworks began, was to make your invocation to the muses. So it's like, well, of course I'm going to start with the muses. And then I thought I would finish it with the Furies, because the Furies are the goddesses that pursue you no matter where you go, right? And they are always chasing you. They're not necessarily quick. You can usually outrun them, but they never stop. So they reminded me of the indie horror film It Follows. Do you remember that? It gave me such a... Oh my goodness, I still think about it. And when someone dressed in white is randomly walking towards me across an open space, I am still now like, oh, after all these years, it's like, that's a horror film that worked, hey? And so I thought, well, that's what I want you to know how cool I thought that was. And I'm going to show you by talking to you about how cool I think the Furies are and how these things fit together. And as I went through the book, I felt more and more kind of aware of the fact that there were some goddesses which I felt, you know, they belonged to us in a kind of historical sense and in a current sense. But there were some goddesses I felt like we'd lost track of, but I really wanted us to get back. And the Furies were one. I think we see them as being kind of scary villains, but actually they operate a really important role, I think, which is to remind people that there are some rules you shouldn't break. And it's been quite a challenge over the last few years politically to see that being disregarded in quite so many places. But there are the Furies. They never stop, you know, maintaining the values that they said they would subscribe to. So no matter how many times you say, oh, I didn't mean it when I said that, I didn't know the full facts, I misspoke, I want to do this, it's like, they're not here for your excuses. They've just got absolute moral views that they don't negotiate with. I wouldn't want my country's justice system to be based on it, but I wouldn't mind us remembering them from time to time, let's say. And the other one was a much kind of a lovelier goddess, Hestia, who I felt she was once everywhere in the ancient Greek world. She was everywhere in the Roman world. She's known as Vesta for the Romans. And she had shrines in every home, in every temple, in every civic space. That Hestia is a hearth. So anytime you burn a sacrifice to any god, which is what is how you make your offerings in ancient Greece, you're also sacrificing to Hestia, to the goddess of the hearth. And she's not just the hearth, she's also a metonym, right? So it's the hearth, the fireplace, but also the fire that burns within it, and also the house that contains it, and the family that makes that house into a home. And so She is the sense of coming home somewhere warm and feeling welcome. That's what Hestia is. And beautifully, and I didn't know this, luckily I've got a friend who's an archaeologist who works in Pompeii. There are lots and lots of shrines to Hestia found in Pompeii at bakeries, because where there is fire to bake bread, then of course you're also worshipping Vesta Hestia in her Roman form. And I was like, how have I not thought more about a goddess who is in every home, in every temple, and also is the goddess of carbs? I just don't know how I missed this. I feel terrible about it. So yeah, next time you go home and have a pizza, it's Hestia you should be thanking.
I've been speaking to Natalie Haynes. Her new book is Divine Might, Goddesses in Greek Myth. Thank you for joining me, Natalie.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.